welcome to Federal Insights for April, sponsored by Akamai.
It sounds ironic, but having a zero-trust approach to network security means you can have more confident trust in users and the safety of applications and data. Tom Temin here, and thanks for joining me. For insight on zero-trust networks and how to get there, I spoke with Dr. Chase Cunningham, principal analyst at Forrester Research, which coined the now popular term zero-trust. We started with what exactly the term means.
So interestingly enough, a few years ago I would have told you it was a concept. Now I would say it's a combination of concept, theory, and technology to, you know, achieve an outcome. And really what we're talking about when we talk about zero trust, conceptual or technology side, is really removing the inherent trust that's built in the networks that causes the problems that we have in cybersecurity. You know, It's really a given that organizations are going to get breached or already breached. And when we talk about zero trust, we talk about making sure that people understand you fight from the inside, you control what you can control, and you remove all those default configurations and excessive trust relationships that go on in networks so that that isn't the problem in the future.
So does it mean you don't somehow technically you don't trust the people using the network, or there are software-to-software relationships that you disable in some manner?
So both. So it's not, you know, and I try and remind people this all the time during workshops, is like, this is not something that should make you bristle about, like, someone doesn't trust me or they don't like me or whatever. This is really about, like, look, our goal in here is to do business, to achieve outcomes in the national sense, to, you know, keep the U.S. running. And really, when we talk about not allowing trust, it's, I don't trust that you will not be the avenue of compromise, and I don't trust that you will always be able to stay ahead of the threat. It's my job as a security professional to make sure that you, the person, are not going to be the one that causes us to fail. So I'm going to remove that possibility from it, and I'm going to do that via things like mandating two-factor, mandating multi-factor, password vaults, all those simple things that you can put in front of people. And then on the farther side of the equation really is making sure that the network itself is built where applications don't do things that they shouldn't need to do, and that you have really good understanding of how things are talking to each other.
All right, let's give an example. Suppose people, and many people in the federal government and any large organization, have mobile devices with applications that might access the network, and there might be mobile applications next door on the same device that don't, and yet somehow within the device there's interaction. Is that a case where you would want to have a zero trust architecture, and how would you get to it?
Well, there's a couple of different ways that you can get to that. You know, there's some solutions that have been out there for a few years that have been trying to carve up the mobile device into sort of the user and business side, and never the two shall touch. Interesting approach. Seems to be that's been a little bit problematic, just because it's hard to make someone, you know, carve up their own mobile device. But really, what we're talking about that's a simpler problem to solve is, if your device is going to access my corporate network, when you reach out to touch my network, I'm going to mandate that device is checked for its patch level, and I'm going to mandate that device is pushed through a multi-factor authentication protocol. And lastly, I'm going to make sure that when that device gets into my network, that it's living and existing within a segment of a network that I have really good visibility on and really good response capabilities on. I'm not going to let that device just sort of jump onto the network and do whatever it needs to do and then roll out. That's not the way that this should work.
And of course, one of the big vectors for cybersecurity breaches is coming in through phishing attacks, which are getting, you know, as you know, really sophisticated, such that even people that do know better sometimes get caught up and click on something. How can zero trust prevent that?
Phishing type of exploitations, is people have extra creds and extra auths that they're not supposed to have. You know, there's no reason for me, like, I'm a researcher, I'm a writer for Forrester, I should not have administrative credentials on my machine. So if someone phished me and then they get my username and password, or they get on my machine and do ransomware or whatever, and then they work their way in the network, if I have credentials that I don't use for business purposes, they can do bad things in the network because of the level of creds that are, given to me. So via zero trust, you make sure that role-based access is put in place, that the networks are carved up, and that if someone does get phished, which is likely, and you realize that is, you know, probable, you say, okay, well, even if you do get fished, I'm going to make sure that you are only allowed to do things that you need for business purposes, not because you think you need them because you should be an admin or whatever else.
And this is something pretty much programmable in network devices now, right? It's just a matter of configuration.
Yeah, so this is, well, it's a main thing about configuration. It's also a thing about ease of use because, good security is just like magic. No one actually knows that it's running. And then the last thing is really being able to make sure that people are put into roles so that you can understand what looks abnormal. Most organizations don't even know what the boundaries of normal look like, so how would they ever know what abnormal activity looks like?
And a lot of agencies, again, like a lot of large organizations, are trying to make things easier for people with the idea of single sign-on, so that when you log on to your machine, however, say with your PIV card, then you can access all of the resources anywhere that you have rights to. But that would seem to operate in opposition to a zero trust concept.
Theoretically, I would say that it is sort of orthogonal to what you would talk about zero trust. But in reality, when we talk about functionality of the business or the organization, I want to make security as easy for them as possible. And I want to make sure that they don't have to sort of figure out a way around security. So if I can enable something like single sign-on that only allows access to applications that that user should have access to, and I mandate things like good application security, good patching, multi-factor, et cetera, my single sign-on actually becomes a benefit to zero trust.
We're speaking with Dr. Chase Cunningham. He's principal analyst at Forrester Research. And let's talk about a couple of situations, again, that the government is dealing with, and that is the rise of cloud computing, where you might be blending your network with other public networks that are supposed to be secure, under the service level agreements you have with them. How does the cloud complicate the idea of zero trust?
Well, the cloud complicates everything in IT, really. I mean, it's giving you massive capability, but it's also introducing massive vulnerabilities and sprawl. So what we like to do when we talk about zero trust as far as cloud goes is actually leveraging virtualization for the purposes that virtualization was built for. Interestingly enough, most organizations that are using the cloud are usually trying to take their old paradigms and their old practices and shove it into this new virtual architecture environment, and they get it wrong, and it just continues to propagate failure. That's why we've actually started pioneering some of this research and some of this effort around using virtualization to build perfect semblances of what the network is supposed to look like and then migrating to that. And that's what virtualization is for. You're supposed to be able to carve stuff up, move it around, manipulate, reconfigure, redeploy, test, train, whatever, and do it that way. You don't take something that was flawed for 20 years, think that it's going to be virtualized and safe and move it to the cloud and call it a day.
And I guess under that system, you can have something that is perfected and keep an image of that. And if something should get corrupted down the line, you can roll back, if you will, to the uncorrupted
exactly.
version and redeploy
yeah,
that.
That's what you want. I mean, that's what virtualization is for, is if you look at let's look at how applications used to be written. Applications used to be written waterfall methodology because they had to get it built, had to get it tested, and then deploy it, and then that was kind of it. Whereas when they started using containers and virtualization, all this other stuff to help write applications, they do iterative. They build a little bit, test it, deploy it, train it, move on. Build a little bit, test it, deploy it, train it, move on. That's what you can do with virtualization in the cloud and infrastructure, so we should be doing that.
Dr. Chase Cunningham is principal analyst at Forrester Research. After this short break, we'll be back with more of the interview. I'm Tom Temin.
The network perimeter has traditionally defined the boundaries of security, but today, agencies need protection wherever applications, data, users, and devices are, both on and off network. Agencies should be doubling down with a zero-trust approach to security. This is Randy Wood, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector for Akamai. Akamai is a leader in mitigating malware, bot, and DDoS attacks and is trusted by all branches of the military and 14 cabinet-level agencies.
Learn more at akamai.com/zero-trust. That's AKAMAI.
Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Chase Cunningham, Principal Analyst at Forrester Research. Federal agencies have been among the most widespread adopters of the zero-trust approach to securing their networks. In this next segment, we started with how software DevOps can morph into DevSec for security. ops.
If you're using virtualization correctly, you can actually leverage all that capability to power what's going on with that development process, because you're making things function in very small, very sort of closed loop systems where you know what's going on, and you do your testing and training and you know, build it, blow it up, whatever, before you ever put it in play. And that's not just something that should apply to applications. That should apply to infrastructure and architecture, and that's what you're able to do with this approach.
And I wanted to ask you about the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, which Homeland Security has had for, and all agencies are supposed to be following for a number of years now. Can you diagnose and monitor for flaws in your zero trust setup such that they come to light and you say, ah, there's one we missed, let's fix that and make sure that that can only be accessed under the right circumstances and by the right applications?
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing that I remind organizations all the time about. You know, not just zero trust, but just good security in play. If you look at the history of where problems have actually occurred in cyberspace, almost entirely never do you find some crazy NSA logic bomb thing that just, you know, activated by itself and AI'd its way out of a network and blah, blah, blah. It's always bad practices, bad management, patching, and usernames and passwords that cause compromise. So if you solve those really simple things, and especially in something like CDM, and you can measure it and make sure you know what's going on, you dramatically improve your overall posture. And I tell people all the time, and that this good security, CDM or otherwise, is not rocket science. This is good blocking and tackling.
And the related program, Continuous Monitoring, or CM, originally the first adopters of that said, well, we're monitoring just to make sure we have the latest patches. And that seems to be still a contemporary best practice 10 or so years on since start of CM.
Yeah, I mean, you've always got to be monitoring everything, and you should be patching as fast as you possibly can without, you know, bringing the network down. But the one thing that comes across pretty regularly when you talk about monitoring is most organizations monitor everything all the time, and they're usually having alerts for the sake of alerts because of an alert. So they're never actually dialed in on what they need to monitor because they haven't carved things up into these very small micro perimeters so that they can know what is really going on.
Yeah, security operations centers, sometimes they're outsourced, sometimes they're operated by the government, sometimes in a hybrid type of mode. And so much data is coming in. Is there certain parameters, certain metrics that you can monitor for and get alerts for that would indicate zero trust isn't operating the way it should somewhere, and those light up red so you can get right on those without too much noise interfering with your ability to interpret what's going on?
Well, there would be, but the problem that we have is most organizations, to the prior point, are still monitoring everything across these giant swaths of network, and they can't even keep up with the volume of traffic that they have coming through because they're looking at everything all the time. And if you buy in on zero trust, if they carve things up correctly, if they sort of re-engineered their architecture and really dialed in on gaining ground and focusing on where they could actually see what mattered, their number of alerts usually actually goes down significantly. To give you an example, I did a multi-week thing with a cruise line. They had 58 security vendors providing 58 different alerting systems into their SOC. There's not 58 problems in security, so how would they ever know what they're responding to is correctly, and how would they ever be effective and optimal? When we got done with the project, they went from 58 to 11. Now, that means they got rid of 30-plus solutions that were providing alerts that were on top of alerts for other things, and now they're actually seeing traffic that matters.
And let's talk about federal adoption of the zero trust, I guess you'd call it, methodology. What's your sense of how widespread that has become, and how adept is the government at building zero trust networks for itself?
So interestingly enough, the government is the organization that I point to that's actually been working really well towards a zero trust build over the last X number of years. And the reason I say that is, if you look back in sort of the history of cyber, the government's been the one that first showed up as far as, you know, taking the hits, them in the financial industry, and learning how to actually adapt and respond and build architectures for security. So they've been working towards zero trust for a long time. They just haven't realized it. Now, the adoption side for this particular approach is gaining ground all pretty much across the board. I spent the summer working with folks on Capitol Hill. I did a bunch of working sessions with different federal agencies. I know that there was a kickoff for 22 different federal agencies as well about diving in on zero trust. And then there's a paper working its way up through all the channels, all the way towards hopefully the White House, to get people to really understand how zero trust applies to these federal networks. And the fact that we have all these federal leadership, CIOs and higher, talking about this stuff means that it's gaining ground. And for the industry, that's great, because this is the only industry, security, where the corporate side follows the Fed.
That is interesting. I think they'd be proud to know that. And if you
it's so crazy, right? It's usually the other way around.
Yeah. So if you're an agency that you don't think you have zero trust yet, do you need to acquire particular technology, or how do you go from point A to point B with respect to getting to zero trust?
So the first thing that they really need to do is step back and say, do I feel like today that I'm 100% certain I can defend the entirety of my environment? And if they're honest, they'll say no. And then the next thing they need to do is go, okay, well, if I accept that reality, what do I do to get to that end state that I want to be? And the way that they do that is they align themselves to a strategy with a lot of research, and there's a decade plus behind this thing, to say, show me how to march down this path, show me a framework to get to it, and let's start moving towards zero trust as our long-term strategy. In the government, the other issue that we have is we have people PCS every 3 to 5 years. So for every organization, you get new leadership in every 3 to 5 years that resets how this stuff is supposed to be architected, and they move to a new strategy. When those organizations that I'm talking to now are buying in on zero trust, they're saying that this will be their strategy for the next 10, maybe even longer years. And that's what a strategy is in cyber. This is not something that you turn on and it's, you know, there's no just switch to push. This is buy in on the strategy, align the technology, focus on the outcome.
So leadership coming in then has to really say, okay, if we're on that course, this is something I shouldn't change, even though, you know, leadership comes in to deal with policy, not technology. So they shouldn't, they should probably keep their hands off of it once they're convinced that the agency.
Your tactics and your technologies may change over time, but your strategy doesn't. Just like I'm retired military, I remember when we jumped in on the war on terror, our main strategic point was we will win the war on terror. Now, we've used different technologies and different tactics along that 20-year path, but it's the same strategy for the past two decades.
Dr. Chase Cunningham is Principal Analyst at Forrester Research. We'll be back with the third and final segment right after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
The network perimeter has traditionally defined the boundaries of security, but today, agencies need protection wherever applications, data, users, and devices are, both on and off network. Agencies should be doubling down with a zero-trust approach to security. This is Randy Wood, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector for Akamai. Akamai is a leader in mitigating malware, bot, and DDoS attacks and is trusted by all branches of the military and 14 cabinet-level agencies.
Learn more at akamai.com/zero trust. That's A-K-A-M-A-I.
Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Chase Cunningham, Principal Analyst at Forrester Research. In this final segment, we discussed how cybersecurity guidance from the National Institute of Standards and Technology applies to zero-trust efforts.
There's a bunch of great information with NIST. There's the CSF. There's some of the other compliance requirements that have come up. But if you actually look through those documents and line up the line items and then look at the research and the decade of stuff behind zero trust, what you see is all those things are parts of that strategy. And what you don't want to do is sit there with a checklist and try and solve this checklist to get towards a zero trust implementation. The right way is to say, my strategy for my organization is to achieve zero trust. I'm going to go down that path and leverage this research and these materials and this plan. And as I do that, I'm going to check things off. So you're not chasing compliance, you're chasing security, and compliance is an outcome that's a benefit.
You have done work with the secretive agencies, the FBI, CIA, National Security Agency. NSA has been a good source of cybersecurity information for federal agencies for a long time. They've had a couple of their own issues, but nevertheless, they are expert in this. How are they at zero trust, and more importantly, at information to help other people get to zero trust?
Yeah, I mean, the NSA is, you know, probably the single greatest shining star of what a zero trust architecture looks like on the federal space. I used to live on Fort Meade before I retired, and you know, I always remember just how how much of a realistic sort of approach to security it was when you got into Fort Meade. You know, you went through multiple levels, everything made sense, you had to do what you had to do to work there, and that was just kind of the way that it was. And if organizations would look at that approach and say, you know, we're not trying to cause people to have issues with monitoring them or whatever else, like, I don't care what you do at home necessarily, but the reality of it is if you're going to use my network, there are things that I put in place to secure this, and this is the way that it has to be. If you don't like that and you can't live with it, there are other places to be employed. And that was what I took away from working at Fort Meade was, you know, security was not optional. It was built into the fabric of your everyday life. And after a while, you kind of, you know, got to where you didn't really mind the fact that they were looking at what you were doing because of the fact you knew it was empowering national security.
And are there any specific types of technologies required? For example, if you have two-factor authentication, pretty much you need some kind of an independent code generation, and there's lots of vendors that have those, that type of thing. Are there other technologies that can enable and help you get to zero trust?
So the short answer is everything applies in zero trust. You know, you need next-generation firewalls. You need multi-factor authentication. You need password vaults. You need mobile device solutions. You need data loss prevention. Like, all of the technologies that are out there should be leveraged to help build zero trust architectures and infrastructures. But the way that you get to that is not buying all that stuff and hoping that you got it right. You work your way from the solvable problems outward, and you apply technology in that methodology.
So there's no such thing as zero trust in a box?
There is not, unequivocally, flat out.
Sounds more like you're dealing with, say, a symphony orchestra, and you've got to learn to play everybody in harmony, is a better analogy than something you can just buy and throw on and you're there.
Yeah, this is more about being able to figure out which solutions enable your strategy and then applying it to that as you go down the path. And you're right, it's very much like being able to conduct that symphony, but when that symphony is conducted correctly, it's a beautiful sound.
And we've been talking mainly about internal users and internal applications or maybe trading partners. What about the idea of digital services that agencies are deploying to the public? Those could be vectors for incoming malware, and yet you don't have the identity certainty that you have with internal users that you have from public users. How does that figure into the whole zero trust equation?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's what we call outside the wire, really. And what we mean by that is what you're talking about, those public-facing assets and the brand itself. So organizations, you know, should spend just as much time and effort in understanding, categorizing, and protecting what's available out there on the internet that people can cause damage and harm to. You know, you don't even have to attack a network and steal data. If you've got enough Twitter bots, you can bring down a site with just bad messaging, and you can cause detriment to the brand. So, you know, it's important for organizations to also understand that you've got to be able to apply those same security concepts and controls and knowledge to those things that are out there on the open internet.
So to continue with the symphonic analogy, then you don't want people in the audience having their cell phones go off and spoiling this perfect performance you've got going down on the stage.
That's a beautiful way of saying it. Well, well said.
That concludes my interview with Dr. Chase Cunningham, Principal Analyst at Forrester Research. For more on this topic and to hear this interview again or share it with colleagues, go to federalnewsnetwork.com and click on Federal Monthly Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for April, sponsored by Akamai on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.